The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The North Carolina Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We are reading this week from the September 27th, 2019 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows, looks like we must be in the Middle Eastern desert. There is, in the center of the drawing, there is a barrel of oil, and it's it seems to be on fire and it's smoking. Standing on the right is the Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and he's pointing his finger across the barrel at the Iranian leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and he's kind of shrugging his arms like, "What did I do?" And the title is "The Risk of War." Should the U.S. punish Iran for an attack on the Saudis? And that is, in fact, our first main story. Saudis blame Iran for oil facility attack. What happened? Saudi Arabia blamed Iran this week for attacks that crippled its oil industry and threatened to plunge the Persian Gulf into war. Drone and cruise missile strikes hit two key Saudi oil facilities, temporarily shutting down half of the kingdom's production, or about 5% of the world's supply. Oil prices surged 19% in the aftermath of the attack, the biggest one-day spike since the 1991 Gulf War. Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen, who are fighting against the Saudi-backed government, initially took credit for sending the drones and missiles, and Iran denied any role. But Saudi officials said the attacks came from the north, not from the Houthi-held territory to the south, and that recovered pieces of the weapons showed that they were Iranian-made. U.S. intelligence officials have also blamed Iran, with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo calling the attack an act of war. After being briefed on his military options, President Trump appeared unsure over how to respond and ordered the Treasury Department to substantially increase sanctions on Iran. Publicly, Trump gave mixed signals about his thinking. At first, he tweeted that the U.S. was locked and loaded and waiting to hear from the Saudis to learn under what terms we would proceed. Later, Trump said he would like to avoid a war and that he believes that Iranian leaders want to make a deal. But Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, ruled out negotiations. "There will be no talks with the U.S. at any level," he said. What the editorial said: "This wasn't just an attack on Saudi Arabia," said the New York Post. "Targeting the world's oil supply is an attack on the global economy, and all the evidence points to Iran's guiding hand. U.S. military action has to be on the table." The Iranians obviously interpreted President Trump's stated willingness to reopen negotiations and his decision not to use force after Iran downed a U.S. drone earlier this year as signs of weakness. Tehran needs to learn that it can't get away with this escalation. "A military response would be foolish," said the Washington Post, "but the attack should not go unanswered. Unfortunately, Trump has crippled his ability to respond effectively. The White House's decision to unilaterally pull out of the 2015 nuclear agreement alienated our allies, who correctly feared it would provoke Iran into becoming more aggressive, not less. The fact that not even our allies can trust the pronouncements of our erratic president will make it even harder to rally the world against Tehran. Trump will also face bipartisan resistance to military action in Congress, where even Republicans are skeptical of U.S. support for Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen. Trump helped trigger this crisis. He seems to have lost any ability to control it." What the columnist said: What happened to America First, said Daniel Larrison in the Atlantic, the AmericanConservative.com. It's astonishing to hear a U.S. president say that he's waiting for the signal from Saudi Arabia about how our nation should respond to an attack that didn't even involve American assets. The U.S. does not have a mutual defense treaty with the kingdom, but Trump has an excessive attachment to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and has repeatedly put Saudi interests over ours, from aiding and abetting the kingdom's bloody campaign in Yemen to excusing the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Now he might let the Saudis drag us into a war over something that has nothing to do with U.S. security. Neutrality is not a valid option in the Saudi-Iranian conflict, said Eli Lake in Bloomberg.com. Despite the Saudis' brutality, the two sides in this regional conflict are not equivalent. Iran is bent on expanding its power in the Middle East. The U.S. and regional allies like Saudi Arabia are trying to contain it. That's why the Trump administration wants a new deal, new Iran deal, that not only restrains Tehran's nuclear ambitions, but also ends its military adventurism. Iran's hardline Revolutionary Guard may have launched this attack to ensure that no new talks occur, said Tom Rogan in the WashingtonExaminer.com. The Guard has concluded that Trump is fearful of a conflict and made a careful calculation that blowing up Saudi oil fields would deepen the animosity between the U.S. and Iran without bringing a military response from Trump. One of the saving graces of Trump's presidency was that there hadn't been a real foreign policy crisis, said Daniel Dresner in the Washington Post. Well, that crisis is finally here, and Trump is woefully unprepared. The administration is understaffed and in disarray, with multiple acting secretaries replacing people who dared disagree with Trump. The president himself vacillates between hawkish threats and invitations to negotiate. All this increases the chances of blundering into a conflict that could devastate the Middle East and the global economy. Other than that, I'm sure everything will work out great. Controversy of the week, Biden versus Warren. Who's more electable? The Democrats are facing a real dilemma, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. What if the party's choice for a presidential nominee comes down to an extreme liberal who's engaged in a race to the left to win over 20-something activists and a fumbling 76-year-old who looks too old to handle the awesome task before him? At last week's Democratic debate in Houston, frontrunner Joe Biden was initially vigorous, but as the night dragged on, his rambling answers became increasingly incoherent, even cringeworthy. In a response to a question about the legacy of slavery, he urged black parents, "Make sure you have the record player on at night." Unfortunately, Biden is blocking any other center-left Democrat like Kamala Harris or Amy Klobuchar from getting traction. Meanwhile, rising star Senator Elizabeth Warren is embracing Medicare for All, reparations for slavery, and other radical ideas popular only on woke Twitter. Surely, though, the Democrats can do better than a 70s retread like Biden, said Charles Blow in the New York Times. His widely mocked record player comment was a revival of the paternalistic 1970s notion that white social workers should instruct incompetent black parents to play their children spoken word recordings in order to expand the kids' vocabularies. To say the least, this is a problematic view for someone who wants to lead today's Democratic Party. Whoever leads the party has to beat Trump, said Timothy Egan in the New York Times, and that's why the former vice president is still ahead in this race. After the debate, Biden's support among Democrats in a new NBC News Wall Street Journal poll rose 5 points from July to 31%. What matters to these Democrats is Biden is a decent, normal guy who bleeds empathy, traits that give him a persistent big lead in the polls over Trump. Despite Biden's age and a penchant for dumb remarks, that makes him the Democrats' safest choice by far. Don't be so sure, said Robin Abkarian in the Los Angeles Times. Warren was as impressive as Biden was pitiful last week, and she surged to 25% in the NBC Wall Street Journal poll, up 6 points since July. The Massachusetts senator is a more authentic and passionate campaigner than anyone realized, and her unwavering commitment to working families may resonate with the blue-collar voters that Democrats so desperately need to win back. Democrats need to stop talking about electability and focus on ideas, aspirations, and principles. Some of Warren's ideas, though, may give those voters pause, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. It won't be easy to convince the 150 million Americans who now have private health insurance to surrender it for Medicare for All. Still, Warren's career-long focus on income inequality and curbing the predations of corporations make her more electable than nervous centrist Democrats yet appreciate. Warren has yet to be truly tested, said Jonathan Last in TheBulwark.com. In a crowded field, she can hide the football about the costs and downsides of her trillion-dollar plans to tax the rich, providing everything free, and completely transform American society. But what happens when the field narrows? The Democrats' worst-case scenario is coming true, said Michael Goodwin in the New York Post. Every candidate but Biden is probably unelectable, and the whole world can see that Biden is slipping. With the primaries beginning in February, the party has only 5 months to get its act together. We're on to our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems it was a good week for sending in the clowns after a New Zealand man brought an emotional support clown to a meeting where he was fired. The clown mimed crying and made balloon animals to lighten the mood. And Joshua Jack said that, aside from losing his job, it was all smooth running. It was a good week for a dish served cold, with reports that John Bolton, whom President Trump forced out as National Security Advisor last week, has already contacted literary agents about writing a memoir of his time in the White House. He has a lot to dish, a source said. And it was a good week for a flicker of self-awareness after President Trump explained his opposition to eco-friendly LED light bulbs by claiming that in the not good light they emit, I always look orange. But it was a bad week for America, home to the highest proportion of climate change deniers, 15% of any developed nation, according to a new YouGov survey. In the runner-up spot is oil-rich Saudi Arabia. It was a bad week for following your dreams after Jenna Evans of California removed and swallowed her engagement ring while dreaming that thieves were trying to steal it. When I woke up and it was not on my hand, I knew exactly where it was, said Evans, who needed emergency surgery to recover the ring from her intestines. And finally, it was a bad week for big government after a Kenyan lawmaker announced a new initiative to curb flatulence on airplanes by cutting down on alcohol and distributing bicarbonate of soda with every meal. If there is any one given irritant that makes people fight on board, it is the fart, said Dr. Lillian Gobo. It is terrible within the plane. And before we leave the page, a short piece, hostage negotiator gets top security post. President Trump this week named Robert O'Brien, the State Department's chief hostage negotiator, as his fourth national security advisor. replacing John Bolton, who was forced out last week. O'Brien was viewed as the safest option inside a White House looking to avoid drama ahead of the 2020 election, officials told the Washington Post. Yet O'Brien worked alongside Bolton in the George W. Bush administration and has praised Bolton's hawkish instincts, excoriating President Barack Obama for what he called a lead from behind foreign policy. O'Brien won the release of Americans held in Turkey, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Libya. He also traveled to Sweden this summer to aid Trump's efforts to get rapper ASAP Rocky arrested for assaulting a man in a street brawl, released from jail. We're on the briefing page. Will you lose your job to a robot? Over the next decade, automation and artificial intelligence could throw 54 million Americans out of work. Why is automation a threat? Rapid technological advances are enabling machines to perform a growing number of tasks traditionally done by humans. Law firms now use artificial intelligence, AI, sophisticated computer programs that can learn from experience, to conduct contract analysis, hunt for client conflicts, and even craft litigation strategy. McDonald's is replacing drive-thru workers with order-taking AI and cashiers with self-checkout kiosks. Walmart is automating truck unloading, while California farms are employing robots to harvest lettuce. From 1990 to 2007, robots replaced about 670,000 U.S. jobs, mostly in manufacturing. Every robot introduced into a local economy claimed 6.2 jobs. That trend will accelerate over the next decade as advances in mobile technology, AI, data transfer, and computing speeds allow robots to act with greater independence. Oxford University researchers concluded in a major 2013 study that 47% of American jobs are at high risk of automation within two decades. McKinsey Global Institute came to a similar conclusion in 2017, warning that by 2030, robots will have forced 16 million to 54 million Americans, as many as a third of U.S. workers, to retrain for a new job. What jobs are most at risk? Generally speaking, those involving repetitive physical tasks in predictable environments. For instance, some restaurants in China have already begun replacing servers with robots. The Palm Beach County Court recently began using four robots: Wally Bishop, Rosie Tobor, Kit Robbie, and Speedy, to read court filings, fill out docket sheets, and input data into its case management system. In theory, at least 91% of a short order cook's tasks can be automated using existing technology. It's 100% for a dredge operator, plasterer, stucco mason, motion picture projectionist, and logging equipment operator. Conversely, jobs that involve managing people, creative thinking, and social interaction will see less automation. But even the jobs you'd think are safe aren't. The Guardian Australia newspaper published its first article this year written entirely by a computer. The Indian e-commerce site Myntra recently created one of its best-selling t-shirts by delegating the design to two algorithms that analyzed previous designs and invented new ones. Sales of AI-designed shirts are growing at 100%, said Anath Narayanan, Myntra's CEO. It's working. How will this affect the workforce? History has shown that previous apocalyptic warnings about technology wiping out the need for human labor have proved untrue. although there is often a difficult transition period to new jobs requiring new skills. In the 19th century, farmers rendered obsolete by mechanized agriculture found their way to new, better-paying jobs in factories. When industrial automation in the 20th century threatened factory workers, many of the displaced transitioned to service work, often with lower salaries, however. If history is any guide, McKinsey said in its study, we could also expect that 8-9% of 2030 labor demand will be in new types of occupations that have not existed before. So will the impact be modest? Not necessarily. The futurist Martin Ford acknowledges the long record of false alarms, but argues that this time is different. The pace of automation, he says, is no longer linear, but exponential, like the growth in computing capacity predicted by Moore's Law. The economy, Ford said, will not have time to create new professions to absorb the tens of millions of workers displaced by automation. By some estimates, America is less than a decade away from autonomous vehicles, and yet 3.5 million Americans still work as truck drivers. White-collar jobs are also at risk for the first time, Ford said. On Wall Street, the number of financial workers has already plunged by 50,000 since 2000, as computers can process 100,000 transactions in a tenth of a second. Radiologists may lose their job analyzing medical images. Displaced workers might find new jobs, but at much lower salaries. How will this affect society? Predictions vary, but there is a lot of grim prognostication about a robot apocalypse. The Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang warns of an automation buzzsaw that will eliminate millions of jobs and lead to political polarization, suicides, drug overdoses, anxiety, depression, as well as derelict buildings, jobless zones, and a hyper-stratified society like something out of the Hunger Games. He, like tech titans Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg, believes that it will be necessary for government to provide a universal basic income to each citizen. Meanwhile, there is some comfort to be had in the claim made late last year by Forrester research team that while 10% of American workers would lose their jobs to automation in 2019, artificial intelligence was still at least 100 years away from sending all of humanity on a permanent vacation. It's time for a few of the best columns of the week. The first comes from Liz Plank at the Washington Post, titled, The Cost of Traditional Masculinity. No man in America should be afraid of feminism, said Liz Plank. The rigid gender roles that feminists want to break down make men's lives more stressful and difficult than they need to be, giving rise to man-made diseases that shorten men's lives. Traditional notions about masculinity lead men to engage in high-risk behavior in their personal lives and in their work, to avoid doctors and psychologists, even when suffering physical and mental pain, and to drink, smoke, and eat poorly. The suicide rate is 4 times higher for men than for women, partly because men think weakness and depression are unmanly, and partly because they are more likely to own guns. Even among minors, more than 80% of gun deaths are of boys. In European countries like Sweden, Austria, and Iceland, where gender equality is real and most women work, male suicide rates are much lower than in the U.S., and men's life expectancy is longer. If men lose their jobs, their wives can shoulder the economic burden for a while without the men feeling shamed. Surrendering lone cowboy masculinity in exchange for a longer and happier life seems like a pretty sweet deal to me. Another column about men from Japan. Can men really take paternity leave? Woe unto the man who openly considers taking paternity leave, said the Asahi Shimbun. Environment Minister Shinjiro Koizumi received an avalanche of criticism last week after he announced he might take some time off to help his wife when their first child is born next year. The 38-year-old son of a former prime minister, Koizumi, is a rising star in the center-right Liberal Democratic Party. But his socially liberal views, he favors letting married women keep their maiden names and thinks fathers should be more involved in day-to-day parenting, is causing a backlash. His detractors, who include former cabinet members, say that Koizumi's government duties will require his presence and that working for the country should be his top priority. Koizumi shot back that his critics were being old-fashioned and pig-headed. Under Japanese law, new dads are entitled to up to a year of paid leave to care for kids. But while 86% of Japanese men want to take paternity leave, only 6% of eligible fathers actually did so last year. Many who didn't cited workplace attitudes that discourage time off. Still, that mindset may be evolving, thanks partly to a new generation of politicians like Koizumi. The seeds of change have been planted. This is from France. Farmers acting like terrorists. Sheep farmers are turning into vigilantes, said Farid Benhamoum, and French officials are doing nothing to stop their lawless behavior. A group of sheep farmers released a video last month showing themselves armed and hooded, imitating terrorists, and demanding that they be allowed to shoot wolves in Écrins National Park. Some farmers have already begun shooting into the air to disturb the protected predators. Others have turned their fury on the authorities. One group of disgruntled sheep breeders dumped heaps of steaming manure at the entrance to the Alpine town of Gap. Yet the government continues to coddle these thugs. After the release of the terrorist video, bureaucrats murmured that they understood the breeders' distress and would do their utmost to accommodate them. Other demonstrators don't get such considerate treatment. When anti-government yellow vest protesters took to the streets, they were met with the repressive apparatus of the state and surveilled under anti-terrorism laws. Farmers, though, are handled as if they enjoy special rights. The fact is, wolves are not a major threat to farmers. Wolves kill perhaps 12,500 sheep a year, while tens of thousands more livestock are lost to rock falls, bad weathers, and diseases. Let's see the police get tough on those who illegally take up arms against wildlife. Time for the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, Learning from Burning Man. A Nobel laureate economist thinks well-designed cities are the key to the future, said journalist Emily Badger in the New York Times. He found a model in a 70,000-person city built in 3 weeks in the Nevada desert. Black Rock City, Nevada. It was dusk on the opening night of Burning Man, and the makers and misfits were touching up their art projects and orgy dens. Subwoofers oomph-oomphed as topless cyclists draped in glowing LEDs pedaled through the desert. And Paul Romer, a reigning laureate of the Nobel Prize in Economics, sat on a second-story porch at the center of it all, marveling at a subtlety of the street grid. The roads narrowed as they approached small plazas around the impermanent city. How clever, he thought. this way of funneling pedestrians toward gathering places, and most burners don't even notice, what with the art projects and orgy dens. It's just like every other city, Romer said, except in this other way, it's like no city ever. White-haired and 63, he was dressed in black gear he'd bought at REI, figuring black was the thing to wear at Burning Man. It was the first time that Romer, former chief economist at the World Bank, had attended the annual Bacchanal. A week earlier, there'd been hardly anything here in the remote desert of northwest Nevada. Then tens of thousands of people had just showed up, many in the middle of the night. They had formed an instant city with a road network and a raucous street life and a weird make-do architecture. It was an alluring sight for an economist who has talked of building cities from nothing. And Burning Man has been more and more on Romer's mind lately, as world politics have made him gloomier. He is ill at ease, behaving like a traditional academic. He's not particularly interested in publishing papers, but he believes winning the Nobel has expanded his possibilities. More people will listen to what he has to say if he can just decide where he wants to direct our attention. Maybe it's here. Romer came to the desert imagining himself as an objective outsider, to Tocqueville among the burners. But Black Rock City started to rub off on him. One morning, a man who called himself Coyote, who was responsible for surveying the city's streets, took Romer around. At the far edge of town, they found a roller coaster that looked likelier than most things at Burning Man to harm you. It was designed for one fool at a time, strapped into an oversized car seat that shot down one side of a 31-foot wooden-shaped U and up the other. Romer, surprising himself, walked up to it. "Should I do this?" he asked Coyote. "If you kill a Nobel Prize winner, it's on you." Then he climbed the stairs to the top of the contraption that had been built days before in a city with no building codes. Heavy metal was blaring. Romer was trussed into place, and then someone gave him a push. Burning Man, to catch up the uninitiated, takes place for a week in the Nevada desert every August into early September. Thousands of avant-garde revelers come to bend their minds, shed their clothes, and incinerate a large wooden effigy. The event is tamer than it used to be, with more Silicon Valley types and fewer anarchists, but it's still wild territory. Romer, who appreciates a bit of shock value, has been showing aerial images of the city in public talks about urban growth for several years. The world, he said, needs more Burning Man urbanization. By 2050, developing world cities are projected to gain 2.3 billion people. Many of those people will move to makeshift settlements on the edge of existing cities, tripling the urbanized land area in the developing world. To be a little grandiose about it, this is a really unique moment in human history, Romer told me last year. We're likely to decide in this time frame what people are going to live with forever. Urbanization in the developed world has largely come to an end. Nearly everyone who would move from farmland toward cities already has. This century, the same mass migration will run its course across the rest of the world. It will take vast expense and sweeping acts of eminent domain to create arterial roads, bus service, trash routes, public parks, basic connectivity. That prospect agitates Romer because the power of cities to lift people out of poverty dissipates when cities don't work. To economists, cities are labor markets, and labor markets can't function when there are no roads leading workers out of their favelas or when would-be inventors never meet because they live in gridlock. Romer's answer is to do with this moment what Burning Man does every summer: stake out the street grid, separate public from private space, and leave room for what's to come. Then let the free market take over. No market mechanism can ever create the road network that connects everyone. The government must do that first. When skeptics say that it will be too hard to plan for large new waves of urbanization, he says, look at Burning Man. They grow to 70,000 people in 1 week. When Romer first proposed this to me, Burning Man as template for the next urban century, I asked if he had ever, well, been to Burning Man. He had not. And so we made two trips there in August, first to see the city surveyed, then a few weeks later to camp in it. He would see firsthand if his provocative argument held up. Romer's logic is connected in a roundabout way to the work that won him the Nobel. Macroeconomists used to think about the world by tallying up quantifiable stuff. Capital, labor, natural resources. They weren't sure how to account for ideas. But Romer, in a seminal 1990 paper, showed that ideas were central to progress. His model of economic growth enabled economists to ask entirely new questions about the modern knowledge economy. Where do ideas come from? How do they spread? Why are cities such hotbeds for creating them? By the late aughts, Romer was sure that cities were the urgent subject of the 21st century. He had a new idea. Charter cities that would be built in the developing world but governed by nations with more advanced economies and more rules protecting, say, property rights and independent judges. He was picturing British area Hong Kong replicated 50 times over. Some developing world politicians were intrigued. Critics cried neo-colonialism. Libertarians largely misread Romer's intentions. They saw new territory where capitalists could shrug off government rules. To Romer, the idea was about seeding the right government rules. Urban planners design too much, while economists cede too much to the market. The answer lies in between, in drawing the street grid on the desert. Burning Man was an even better model for Romer's purpose than he knew. The event began in 1986 as a rejection of rules. There was no central authority, no prohibitions, no assigned camping spots. In the early years, people brought fireworks and guns. They raced through the desert night with headlights off. They fired hunting rifles from moving vehicles at vacant cars. A lot of people, and I was one of them, thought that Burning Man was about this crazy feeling you could have being with really creative people that are all anarchists, and there is no order, and it's just amazing what can come out of that, said Harley Dubois, who attended those early years. And what came out of that was some people getting hurt. In 1996, a man on a motorcycle playing chicken with a large vehicle was killed. Then a rave set up 2 miles north of the main camp got out of hand. Three people inside tents were run over and seriously injured. Today, the event's six founders are the people who reconstituted Burning Man after 1996, including Dubois. The anarchists drifted away, and the founders created a street grid, an early version of what would become a semicircular city with all the arterial roads converging on a giant, flammable human figure in the center. They invented a sense of superordinate civic order, so there would be rules and structure in streets and orienting spaces and situations where people would feel a common purpose together, where people could become real to one another. Larry Harvey, one of the founders, recounted in an oral history before his death last year. The goal now, one planner explained to Romer, is to make Black Rock City just safe enough that people can joke about dying without actually dying. 3 weeks before Burning Man began, Romer and I drove 100 miles north from Reno to the tiny nearby town of Gerlach, then 15 more miles north onto the parched mud of the playa, arriving at last at precisely the spot in the middle of nowhere where the man statue would stand. When I had first explained this spring that I wanted to come out to the desert with a famous economist to see the parts of Burning Man people take for granted, no one was surprised. 2 years ago, word of one of Romer's talks at the World Bank mentioning Black Rock City had found its way to people here. They were equally curious about him. Romer's nerdy interest delighted everyone. He recited details of their city plans, photographed their traffic cones, and accepted one of their wooden street pegs as if it were an honorary degree. I think they have some experience in doing this that's maybe unique in the world, he said the next day at dawn. He was watching a crew raise the city's outer fence, their pile drivers ringing like cowbells across the desert. Romer was beginning to incorporate these characters into his thinking. What they do here is a model for any place with few resources but enough volunteers to survey new neighborhoods on the urban periphery. But on a grander scale, if you ever persuade someone to build a new city, maybe the people to call are at Burning Man. 3 weeks after the survey, Romer and I returned. The dusty streets were now clearly defined as the space between what people had invented at one intersection, a passport office for burners who wanted to record their adventures around Black Rock City. On another corner, a troop of fire performers from Canada was camped, and on another, a half dozen drivable pieces of art were parked. There was also a row of 36 portable toilets, and behind that, Brand UR Ass and More, a camp where it was possible to get both a drink and a faux branding of the Burning Man logo. While we were standing at the intersection, a man in a great beard and a blonde wig approached with a hug. Levi, 35, was part of a camp running a 24-hour bar up the street, and we learned that he had lately been riding motorbikes across Africa, was about to apply to graduate school to study cognitive science. Levi, who did not know whom he was talking to, mentioned to Romer that his hero was Daniel Kahneman, the 2002 winner of the Nobel in Economic Sciences. Well, I won the Nobel Prize last year, Romer said, so Danny is a fellow laureate. Levi's face lit up, and we then spent the next 45 minutes wandering around the neighborhood talking about economics and human behavior and scarcity. Nearly everything in Black Rock City is effectively free, but you're supposed to respond with some type of gift to the people around you. A piece of advice, a turn in a hammock, a hot dog. At Levi's bar, we were given cups of something cold and orange and alcoholic. Romer, in a comparable act of generosity, then offered Levi his email address. He would happily write a recommendation for grad school, he said. Levi, floored, went in for another hug. Theirs was exactly the kind of encounter that a city generates over and over again until someone gets into grad school and someone else finds a job and someone else begins to earn more than $2 a day. In Romer's Nobel lecture, he implored people to think of cities, especially in the developing world, as places where people get the benefits of interacting with one another. But we have to make the cities viable first, when it's still possible to draw what they might become. If we take a pass on this, he warned, the opportunity will be gone. A version of this originally appeared in the New York Times. Read a couple of the health and science articles this week, starting with the day that doomed the dinosaurs. Using rock samples extracted from deep beneath the Gulf of Mexico, scientists have created a detailed sequence of events of the most calamitous day for life on Earth, when a 6-mile-wide asteroid smashed into the planet 66 million years ago and brought an end to the age of dinosaurs. The geologic account was unearthed by an international team that used a drilling rig to tap into the heart of the asteroid's crash site, the 125-mile-wide Chicxulub crater off Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. The extracted cores show that hundreds of feet of sediment built up rapidly after the impact, reports the Wall Street Journal. We have 430 feet in a single day, says study co-leader Sean Gulick from the University of Texas at Austin. We can read it on the scale of minutes and hours. The strike itself blasted a cavity in the ocean floor some 20 to 30 miles deep and sent a colossal plume of lava into the air, creating a peak higher than Mount Everest. It collapsed within minutes, pushing out huge waves of lava that solidified into a ring of peaks. Seawater began washing over these peaks some 20 minutes later, blanketing them in the impact rocks and shards of volcanic glass. Finally, backwash from the mega tsunamis triggered by the impact added more finely graded debris. That included charcoal, evidence of great fires sparked on nearby land masses by the heat of the asteroid strike. The sediments suggest the blast also blew hundreds of billions of tons of sulfur from crushed ocean rock into the atmosphere, blocking off the sun and causing a global winter that would kill off 75% of life on Earth. Further analysis of the rocks, Gulick says, will yield more insights. The discoveries keep coming. Nap for heart health. Good news for nap lovers. Catching some daytime shut-eye a couple of times a week may lower your risk of heart attack and stroke. That's the finding of researchers from the University Hospital of Lausanne in Switzerland, who tracked 3,462 healthy adults, ages 35 to 75, for 5 years. They noted that participants who dozed for 5 minutes to an hour, once or twice a week, were 48% less likely to suffer a heart attack, stroke, or heart failure than those who never snooze in the daytime. Napping longer or more often didn't deliver any additional health benefits. The study was only observational and so couldn't prove cause and effect. And the researchers say it's still unclear exactly how napping might influence heart health. Our best guess, lead author Nadine Hausler tells NBCNews.com, is that a daytime nap just releases stress from insufficient sleep. And we'll move right on over to the talking points page, starting with a vape ban. Good news for tobacco? President Trump's proposal to ban flavored e-cigarettes may drive many Americans back to cigarettes, said Christopher Palmieri and Jeff Green in the Los Angeles Times. Responding to an outbreak of hundreds of serious lung illnesses from a bootleg vapes that killed a seventh person this week, Trump said the Food and Drug Administration will outlaw everything but tobacco-flavored vapes, as Michigan and New York State recently did. Flavors like buttered popcorn and mango helped create an explosion in teen vaping, and Trump said concern for his 13-year-old son, Barron, helped make up his mind. But hundreds of thousands of teens already addicted to nicotine and 9 million adults who vape may simply replace vaping with tobacco products. By banning flavored vapes, said Amanda Mole in TheAtlantic.com, Trump may be closing the barn door after the horse has gotten out. Nobody vapes because the flavor is so awesome, said David Marcus in TheFederalist.com. That's why Trump's ban is so clueless. If kids want to taste bubblegum, they can buy, you know, bubblegum. Vaping giants like Juul need to be upfront about the fact that they're in the nicotine business and police themselves accordingly. They should spend billions ensuring that retailers don't sell to minors while rightfully touting the scientific consensus that e-cigarettes are safer than smoking. The combustion involved in smoking cigarettes creates tar and a host of carcinogenic chemicals not present in e-cigarettes' watery vapor. True, but nicotine is also a dangerous and addictive drug, said David Von Drail in the Washington Post. And vaping fluid itself contains chemicals that damage blood vessels. The idea of safe smoking is a lie, and the vaping industry's fruit and candy-flavored pods are proof of evil intent. The massive surge in teen vapors is a legitimate concern, said Robert Gebelhoff in WashingtonPost.com. But the evidence suggests that the lung illnesses that led Trump to act were caused by black market cartridges of marijuana oil cut with dangerous vitamin E acetate. Banning flavored vapes will only drive more nicotine addicts and teens to the black market, which will be happy to provide fruity pods. Instead of banning flavors, the government should empower the FDA to fully regulate the industry. That would let science, not hysteria, guide our policy. Climate change. Abandon all hope. Let's stop pretending we can stop the climate apocalypse, said novelist Jonathan Franzen in The New Yorker. There is virtually no hope of keeping the global average temperature from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, the target scientists say we must meet to avoid catastrophic climate change. To achieve that goal, the people of every country on Earth would have to institute draconian energy conservation measures, embrace higher taxes and energy costs, and accept severe curtailment of their familiar lifestyles. People don't like sacrifices, especially for some future common good, and I don't see human nature fundamentally changing anytime soon. It would be more realistic to spend our resources preparing for the disasters of fire, flooding, and famine to come. We must rethink what it means to have hope. No matter what Franzen says, we are not doomed, said climate scientist Kate Marvel in ScientificAmerican.com. Yes, it's very likely we'll shoot past the 2-degree limit, but it's wrong to suggest that there is some kind of climate threshold after which all hope is lost. Degrees are a human construct, and like the proverbial frog, we won't know exactly when Earth passes the 2-degree mark. We do know, however, the risk of something terrible increases with the concentration of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. The fight to reduce emissions could mean the difference between a planet that is uncomfortably warmer and one that is unimaginably, catastrophically different. That's why Franzen's climate defeatism is even more dangerous than denial, says Bina Venkataramanan in The Washington Post. It will always be worth trying to do more to cut carbon emissions. Franzen isn't quite right about giving up hope, said Kevin Drum in MotherJones.com, but he does have a point about human nature. The best way to fight climate change will be to invest in energy technology to make it cheap, plentiful, and green, instead of fruitlessly pleading with people to use less of it. Certainly the challenges we face are vast, said Jeet here in TheNation.com, but it's wrong to assume that society can't make large-scale changes. Before the rise of abolitionism in the 18th century, there were many who would argue that slavery was an essential part of human nature and our economy, and so it could never be eradicated. A novelist should have a bigger imagination for what's possible. Pollution, rolling back clean water rules. The Trump administration has revealed its grand plan for turbocharging economic growth, said Catherine Rampell in The Washington Post. Make drinking water dirty again. Motivated by the mistaken belief that pro-environment policies must be bad for business, it has scrapped an Obama administration rule that prohibited the dumping of toxic chemicals, pesticides, and chemical fertilizers into the smaller lakes, streams, and wetlands not specifically protected by the 1972 Clean Water Act. Former EPA officials say the repeal will mostly benefit oil and mining operations and developers who can now fill in wetlands or pollute without a federal permit. The rule change also reverts America to water pollution standards from 1986, a year from Trump's favorite decade, although not exactly a high watermark, so to speak, for environmental protections. Don't buy the hype, said the New York Post in an editorial. Team Trump's move wasn't a blow against clean water, but a win for basic justice. By adding terms like adjacent waters and tributaries to the Clean Water Act's coverage, the Obama administration basically expanded federal oversight to virtually anything that gets wet. This includes vast amounts of dry land that turn into shallow wetlands after a good hard rain. This overreach has created massive uncertainty for farmers, ranchers, and home builders who had to worry that the presence of a pond would result in huge fines from the Environmental Protection Agency. All those worries are now lifted. The 2015 rule was an indispensable safeguard for 1 in 3 Americans who rely on streams and surface water for their drinking water, said Ula Chorobak in PopularScience.com. And it's not as if polluting smaller streams and wetlands won't harm the larger waterways as well. In 2015, the EPA cited 1,200-plus studies to conclude that the health of smaller streams and wetlands is vital to large downstream rivers, too. In the Mississippi Basin, for example, the pollutants from numerous farms that trickle into small streams and wetlands eventually flow into the river and then into the Gulf of Mexico. But this is a point that has eluded President Trump, said George Ochesinke. All he knows is that when he turns on the faucets in Trump Tower, the water flows up 58 floors to his gilded penthouse. But for the rest of us, water does run downhill, and all of us live downstream from something. And just time for a quick quote from Ronald Dahl, who says, "A little nonsense now and then is relished by the wisest men." And that's it for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The North Carolina Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.